President Trump is back in the White House today after being hospitalized this weekend for COVID-19. While there are still some unknowns about his condition, he says he's ready to participate in the next presidential debate and get back to campaigning. Trump isn't the only president who's been sick during their tenure in the White House. And when that happens, administrations have historically downplayed their conditions. With only 28 days left before Election Day, what impact could the president's diagnosis have on voters? And what precedent is there for a sick president to be on the campaign trail? You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the impact this could have on the election? Do you remember incidents in the past where presidents were ill in the White House or presidential candidates sick on the campaign trail? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Lily Gorin is a professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. She's the author of multiple books on political science, including as co-author Mad Men and Politics, Nostalgia, and the Remaking of Modern America. Lily, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on today.
Lily, what historical precedents have been popping into your mind over this last few days since the president revealed his diagnosis?
Well, obviously, the first one that many political scientists and historians started to think about and talk about was Woodrow Wilson, who had a fairly debilitating stroke in the last 2 years of his second term, and really was very much sort of kept from public view. And his wife, Edith Wilson, really kept many people from him. And limited how many people also knew about his condition, but he was significantly disabled at that time. Of course, obviously, we have the fact that Franklin Roosevelt, as president, was mostly in a wheelchair because of his early polio experience. But in 1944, when he was running for his unprecedented fourth term, he was really at a elevated point of congestive heart failure. And he died, as we know, soon after he was inaugurated in 1945. So those were the first ones that came to mind.
Now, it took the United States a long time to figure out what happens if a president is incapacitated because of illness or passes away in office, and really understanding procedures. Can you talk about the slow evolution there?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, the Constitution provides for a president and a vice president. And the reason why the Constitution actually provides for the vice president is because of the Electoral College structure. Because the requirement is that the electors vote for two individuals, one of whom cannot be from the same state as the electors. And at the Constitutional Convention, they sort of said, oh, well, we've got this other guy who's got a bunch of votes. What should we do with him? We'll make him vice president. And so they integrated the vice president into the constitutional system. Obviously, the vice president assumes the powers of the presidency if the president dies in office. The question of disability is a little bit more complicated, because the question then becomes how and in which ways is a president disabled in office? And then, you know, over time, it's kind of evolved in terms of the informal processes. And ultimately, we got to the 25th Amendment that came after Kennedy's assassination, but also after Eisenhower had been disabled by both a heart attack and a stroke while he was in office. And there was concern that after Kennedy was shot, if he had not passed away immediately, but had been significantly disabled, how the country was supposed to function.
And there were a lot of instances in the past. You mentioned President Woodrow Wilson, and then Eisenhower's heart problems were initially reported, I believe, by his administration as digestive troubles. Yeah. It seems like it would be hard to do something like that in the present day. Is that fair to say?
It's harder. And, you know, certainly there's the sort of question of how you can sort of keep some of that information from getting to the public. Obviously, there were other presidents like Kennedy who also had Addison's disease that nobody knew about at the time that he was president. And you know, you also have the famous Grover Cleveland's famous yacht trip where he was said to go fishing and in fact had cancer removed from the upper palate of his mouth on the water in another sort of clandestine sort of medical move while he was president. And so you have a number of situations where presidents have had some sort of infirmities or problems that were not at the time disclosed to the public. And so it is more difficult in the post-Watergate era, where we have investigative journalism and you know, reporters and writers who are sort of paying attention to lots of different aspects of the president and the presidency, and following, you know, sort of trails of breadcrumbs sometimes to get at some of this information. And again, you know, sort of famously, FDR had the, quote, gentleman's agreement with most of the press that he wouldn't be photographed from essentially the mid-chest down. So there weren't very many pictures of him ever seen during his time in office in a wheelchair.
Talking to Lily Gorin from Carroll University in Waukesha, looking at President Trump's COVID-19 diagnosis and historical precedents of what happens when presidents have health problems while in office. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Will is with us in Eau Claire. Will, hi.
Hi, guys. Appreciate your show, as always, and especially this topic. What I'm wondering about is if the guest can address the notion that past presidents have certainly attempted to disguise and conceal different various, you know, illnesses. But this one seems different in terms of its risk to the public in general, which is, you know, a given. And couple that with the guy lies all the time. So anyway, I'll take my answer off the air, and thanks for listening.
Will, thanks for the call. Let's start with the second point first. Lily, Will saying the president had credibility problems coming into this. Does this make it harder for the public to sort out what they're hearing from the White House?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think that does bear on, you know, some of the information that has been communicated. And also, in places where the public has had some questions, and again, the media is the one asking the questions of either the president or his physicians or other White House staff and you know, press secretaries and so forth, it is about, you know, some of the loss of credibility and trying to understand some of the information that is not fully disclosed with regard to the president's condition. And so I think that is somewhat problematic here. And also that we have this kind of history associated with the president's health, not just President Trump, but president's health in general, and not having full information about that when the person is in office.
And Will also raises the point that this is an infectious disease that the American government has been trying to cope with now, 210,000 Americans dead, concerns that depending on how you define super spreader event, the White House may have just hosted one. Is this particular a health problem, given that it's also a top public policy problem? Does that make this different?
Yeah, it is a little bit different. Again, you know, some people have congestive heart failure, or they have, you know, a genetic disposition towards hypertension. And that's not something that is communicable. It is something that, you know, one person has and the other person doesn't, or cancer or something. But with regard to COVID, obviously, we've spent the last 6 months, you know, sort of learning about it and understanding that, you know, one should keep social distancing and mask wearing and washing hands, and that it is highly contagious. And for some people, it can be also lethal in that regard and can be debilitating in a variety of ways, according to what the research is telling us. And so it does operate differently than, say, Eisenhower's heart attack, or Wilson's stroke, because that's not something that somebody else was going to get from them.
Thanks, Will, for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Lily Gorin right now, professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. She's with us to talk about the history of presidential illnesses and health problems and how President Trump's COVID-19 diagnosis could fit into the November election. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your reactions to the president's diagnosis, how the White House has handled it so far, whether you think it matters when it comes to the election. And if you have questions about some of the history here and how it all works, call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up a conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation about the history of presidential illnesses and health problems in the White House and what effect, if any, President Trump's recent COVID-19 diagnosis could have on his reelection campaign. Lily Gorin stays with us, professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your reactions, and your questions. Call in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go back to your calls now. Rick is with us in Sparta. Rick, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. We have the 25th Amendment that pretty clearly, you know, points out how the power will be shifted. The only thing you didn't talk about is when the House of Representatives gets involved. And then the other thing is, you know, with Trump and his COVID experience, the one thing that the news media, and not picking on anybody, but there's a little thing called HIPAA, which means all medical stuff is, it can't be leaked out. It's against the law.
Rick, thanks a lot for the call. That'll be the subject of another conversation for today's show. But anyone can authorize their medical information to be released, of course, under HIPAA. But let's focus on his other question there a little bit. Rick's question, Lily, about how the 25th Amendment works. Who, I guess, makes the call?
Yeah, the 25th Amendment is an interesting amendment in a variety of ways. And I refer to it sometimes in my classes when we're learning about the Constitution and all the amendments as the Hollywood Amendment. And it's just the section that Rick was pointing out, which is section 4 of the 25th Amendment, which is, you know, this discussion that the majority of the cabinet and the vice president can essentially relieve the president of his power if they determine that they think he is unable to execute the powers of the office. Congress can also get in on this in terms of designating another group that could determine the president's disability and relieve the president of the power, but the cabinet and the vice president are usually the way that people think about it. But we've never actually seen that part of the 25th Amendment in real life, but it's in the movies and television shows all the time as a plot device. So the West Wing did it a couple of times, 24 did it a couple of times, Commander in Chief did it at the beginning of the show. We've seen it in Designated Survivor, Air Force One, it's discussed, White House Down. I could go on and on. And there's a reason why I refer to it as the Hollywood Amendment and not the other sections of the amendment. And I'm also not trying to make light of presidential disability, but that we have not, as a country, experienced the process of the cabinet, majority of the cabinet, and the vice president basically determining that the president is not able to discharge his duties.
Thanks a lot for the call, Rick. Let's go to Mary Beth now in New Berlin. Mary Beth, hi.
Hi there. This may have been addressed with that last answer. I'm concerned about the steroid that he's taking. And if his mental health is impacted, is there something in place for that?
Thanks a lot for the call, Mary Beth. I mean, I guess that would be under the 25th Amendment again, Lily, but that would be a heck of a judgment call for, say, the vice president and members of the cabinet or in the Hollywood example of Congress.
Right. And again, this is where, you know, the Section 4 part is really sort of detailed in terms of the cabinet, two-thirds of the cabinet and the vice president have to sort of sign that the indicating that the president doesn't have the capacity to discharge his duties. And it doesn't say in what way the president has been disabled. And then the president at the same time can challenge that and can challenge it to sort of take his power back from the vice president, essentially, by essentially making the case that he is able to discharge his duties. And again, we've seen this in fiction, but we haven't really seen it in fact.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Lily Gorin, professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University, looking at President Trump's COVID-19 diagnosis, looking at some historical precedent of this kind of thing happening and what it means for the presidential race. Lily, have we seen an illness like this, a public illness out on the presidential campaign trail, maybe affecting how voters perceive a presidential candidate?
Well, again, this is where the sort of example of FDR in 1944 running what became known as a Rose Garden campaign, because he was so physically compromised by his heart failure that he really couldn't go on the hustings in any real way. And so, you know, it was sort of making speeches from the Rose Garden or from the White House in certain regards. I will add just a little tiny piece of history here that our third president, Thomas Jefferson, actually was afflicted for most of his life by a lot of different maladies like migraines and so forth. And in 1800, when he was first running for president, he was a bit unwell, but his opponents all said that he, in fact, may have been dead. And he kept then having to come back and say, no, I'm fine. I'm not dead. And I'm running for president. So I don't know if that's a really good parallel for our current situation. And I'm not saying that the president in any way is saying that he is not dead or dead, but that we do have, you know, sort of way back in our history, this kind of tortured attack on Jefferson, in part because he was somewhat ill during the campaign season, although they didn't campaign like we do now.
And let's talk about how somebody runs against somebody dealing with illness. Just 4 years ago, we had Hillary Clinton having a bout with pneumonia during the campaign, the Trump campaign, definitely talking about that. We had the Biden campaign, at least while the president was hospitalized, saying we're pulling negative ads. I believe that grace period is over now. Can you talk about how that affects the person running against someone dealing with that public illness?
Well, and again, this is, you know, this goes to where the sort of narrative around campaigns is complex. And, you know, you don't want to sort of hit somebody while they're down is the kind of thinking on a lot of that. But at the same time, there is this question of whether or not you run a positive campaign. So focusing on, in the case of Biden, just on him and on his policies and on what he's running on, as opposed to negatively campaigning against the president.
Let's bring on one more caller. We've got Nancy with us in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi.
Hello. My comment is that I do think that Trump has had a mild form of this virus, but I think that because he's been watching the polls all along and he realizes he's so now far behind Biden, he, in the coming weeks, is going to use this as a contrivance to actually walk away from the election. I feel strongly that this is a very proud man. He will never allow himself to lose an election. He would never be willing to make a concession speech to anybody about anything, and his adult children feel exactly the same way.
Nancy, thanks a lot for the call. So very speculative there, obviously, Lily.
Yeah. And again, you know, this is we're in the middle of voting. We already have 3 million people who have cast ballots, and Donald Trump's name is on the ballot. So even if he were to sort of, you know, as the caller suggested, kind of walk away from the election, the ballots won't be changed at this point. The party would have to sort of designate somebody in his stead, and likely it would be Mike Pence. But again, all of this is kind of speculation. But it is, you know, it is sort of this weird liminal kind of space in terms of, at least over the weekend, you know, how is Trump going to campaign? Is he fit to campaign if he has COVID and so forth?
For a lot of reasons, I think, Lily, in our last minute or so, 2020 is going to be the subject of a lot of interest for the historians and political scientists of the future, right? We're living through a point in history that a lot of people are going to be talking about for a long time.
Yes, ask most political scientists in the United States who study American government. We're all a bit exhausted.
We'll leave it there, Lily. Thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks for having me on today.
Lily Gorin is a professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. She's the author of multiple books on political science, including as co-author, Mad Men and Politics, Nostalgia and the Remaking of Modern America. She joined us today to talk about President Trump's recent COVID-19 diagnosis, its potential impact on the election, and how it fits into a broader history of presidential illnesses and health problems in the White House.